We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with you at the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have both of you here. John, returning from sunny Arizona.
Yes, and nobody checked my papers for some reason. I can't understand why.
Keep working on that tan.
Yeah.
Okay. So starting out with local and some video that has been making the news a lot lately.
Yeah, Seattle Police Officer Shandy Cobain, the video that was taken of him during a robbery investigation where they had a number of suspects laying on the ground. Officer Cobain kicked a young Hispanic man in the head and uttered a racial slur at him, and then another officer
and a profane racial slur at that.
Yeah, Officer Mary Lynn Woolham then stepped up to the suspect and stomped on the back of his leg. That was captured on video. When I saw the video, my first thought was, well, I've seen this before. Of course, if you don't capture it on video, then there's not an uproar. But also, the next thing that I found kind of interesting was the date when this actually occurred and the fact that the video didn't come out and wasn't made an issue of until weeks after the event.
Several interesting things here. One of them is that Woolham, the woman who stomped on the suspect's leg, and the suspect incidentally wound up not being charged any particular crime because he hadn't done anything.
Right.
That she was involved in the fatal police shooting in, I believe, 2003. So she has a history.
Well, in addition to another incident where a suspect was beaten so severely, he had to be admitted to the hospital.
Yeah. The other thing that was interesting about this was the whole uproar over what happened to the video and why there was such a delay over it. Apparently, the photographer who took the video was working freelance for Q13, the Fox TV affiliate here in Seattle. And Q13 sat on the video for weeks before the photographer got fed up and gave it to Cairo TV instead, which promptly made it its top news story last week. And that's how it was disseminated. Initially, Fox was threatening to sue the photographer, claiming that the video was their property. And the photographer was saying, look, they didn't want to air it. They were sitting on it, never going to air it because they didn't want to endanger their relationship with SPD. That is a big journalistic no-no, not that television news has ever been confused with journalism, but you know they do try and at least keep up appearances. Now, most recently, the news director at the Fox affiliate has resigned, and a lower-level staffer has been fired over this incident. So there has been some accountability on that, but still very disturbing that the local media would go to such lengths to cover for a pretty egregious example of police violence.
Yeah, exactly. And then what I also found interesting is Interim Chief John Diaz, who has up to this point refused to take any responsibility for this kind of conduct on the part of his officers that he's supposed to be overseeing. He has only just in the last day or so issued an apology to the man. To the victim of this incident.
Can you say lawsuit?
Yeah. And he's put the two officers on administrative leave, but he says that they're doing some internal investigation, but he's not said that there's an official internal investigation going on.
Yeah, and that investigation, by the way, has now been expanded to also include the other officers who were standing around watching this who did not intervene.
Yeah, and you can see that very clearly when you watch the video that the other officers, this is just sort of the normal course of our business.
Oh, cool.
You know?
Oh, look, she's stomping on his leg. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, they weren't, you know, they didn't even react. It was just sort of like, oh, well, you know, business as usual, you know, which says a lot about the Seattle Police Department, I think.
Yeah.
And the fact that Interim Chief Diaz has refused to also withdraw from the selection process for a permanent chief also says something, too.
Yeah, and this came in the week when Diaz was named one of the three finalists for the permanent police chief job as selected by Mayor McGinn. This cannot help his chances the way that he's handled this whole situation.
Right, especially when the other two candidates look so much better, you know, up against him. At this point, anyway.
All right. Moving on, it appears there's not going to be a new jail for greater Seattle area?
That's right. This has been fairly controversial for the last year or so among service providers here in town, that particularly under Mayor Nichols, there was a real insistence on building a new jail. The problem that had been posed for city officials was that their agreement with the King County for housing misdemeanor offenders with King County was set to expire in, I believe, 2014, and they were looking at the continued rising rate of misdemeanor offenses for which people were being jailed, most of them nonviolent drug offenses, and were looking at the jail capacity and saying, look, we have to build a new jail. Of course, this is always the first response of local political leaders. It's let's go for the big ticket item and maybe get our name on a plaque on the side if the whole building isn't named for us. But rather than say the more sensible reaction, which is maybe we shouldn't be throwing nonviolent drug offenders in jail in the first place, but
sending them to treatment programs instead.
But to his credit, and I have to say that my skepticism over Mayor McGinn is, as people listening to this show, I was somewhat skeptical of him when he was a candidate last year, and I'm starting to be willing to concede that I was wrong on this. He's done a number of pretty good things in his time as mayor, and seems to be getting his legs under him in the past month or so. He negotiated with Dow Constantine, the King County executive, to continue to have King County continue to house misdemeanor offenders through the year 2020, that thereby obviating the need for a new jail. And he canceled the new jail this week, so that will save the city quite a bit of money that it otherwise would have spent on this facility. And of course, that also opens the door for there not being a financial incentive to avoid things like drug court and other treatment intervention and other ways of keeping people out of jail who really shouldn't be there in the first place.
All right. Moving on, Governor Christine Gregoire might be looking at a new job offer coming up here soon.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about Elena Kagan in a moment, the President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court. Her current job is as Solicitor General, and if she is confirmed for the Supreme Court, which looks pretty likely at this point, then somebody is going to need to become the new Solicitor General, and the person at the top of that list, according to numerous sources in D.C., is Washington Governor Christine Gregoire. Now, this would be a great career move for Gregoire, particularly as she is widely expected not to run for re-election in 2012, and probably wouldn't have that good a chance of winning a third term, even if she did run. But it's not so good news for Washington State, particularly because if she leaves, in the short term, she would be replaced by the lieutenant governor, who is the execrable Brad Owen, who has, since the lieutenant governor has really no job duties other than to be around in case the governor gets struck by lightning or appointed to higher federal office. Brad Owen has been using his position for the last dozen years or so, mostly to stump for an increasingly aggressive war on drugs. He is probably one of the most conservative statewide Democrats in the state, and him as governor is a very, very troubling prospect. Now, if Gregoire were to resign before May 31st, a special primary and general election would be held this summer. If she resigns after May 31st, and given that Kagan isn't likely to resign as Solicitor General until she gets approved by the Senate, so it's more likely to be after May 31st, then we would wait until the August primary and the November general election to nominate and elect a new governor. And if, for God help us, it's after October 3rd, then Owen would fill out the remaining 2 years of Gregoire's term. The other disturbing part of this is once an election is held, who the most likely people to be filling the election would be. Right now, the odds-on favorite to win a special election for governor would have to be considered Dino Rossi, because he's the person with the statewide name ID. The Democrats, unless you get somebody like Jay Inslee, who would have to walk away from a very secure congressional seat in order to do it. The Democrats really don't have anybody who has a statewide name ID to compete in a very short window for an election of this sort. And this could be a scenario in which Rossi, who had been rumored to be considering taking on Patty Murray for a Senate, might get his wish after all and become governor. And that, again, I don't know whether I'd rather see him or Brad Owen, but I think moving to Arizona might be a sensible option at that point. Right. Especially if you're white.
Moving on to national and update on the ever-growing oil spill.
Yeah, no, this week there were a lot of revelations about the Minerals Management Service, the government agency that's supposed to oversee permitting as well as the safety regulations involved in drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and in Alaska and other U.S. waters. Well, it turns out the Mineral Management Service has been allowing drills to go ahead without getting permits from the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which are required under the Endangered Species Act for companies that want to drill in offshore waters. Well, not only is the Minerals Management Service skipping that important regulatory step in the process, the MMS scientists are complaining that whenever they write an impact statement that would deny a permit for environmental reasons, their supervisors at the MMS have been either ignoring the reports, stuffing them in a desk drawer, rewriting them, or simply giving it to someone else to write a favorable report instead.
Yeah. Now, a lot of this happened under the Bush administration, although some of it apparently has been continuing.
Mm-hmm.
But the other interesting thing out of the Minerals Management Service was that apparently they had regulations all written up for additional controls on the blowout preventers, which is the piece of equipment that failed in the case of the Deepwater Horizon and this spill. Those were all set and ready to go in 2001. They were shelved by the Bush administration when they came into power in 2001. And there was a priceless quote from somebody at MMS saying, well, as far as we know, those regulations are still sitting down at headquarters in a drawer somewhere. Regulations that might well have prevented this disaster from occurring were ready to go on the books 10 years ago, 9 years ago, actually, and they were prevented from doing so by the former president of Halliburton, now Vice President Cheney, and his oil patch buddies in the White House.
Yeah, and they did other things too. The Bush administration leaned on the Minerals Management Service to do other things, to give gifts to oil companies. Another thing that they have been doing is they've been giving blanket exemptions to all oil companies from having to provide any environmental impact statements for drilling and offshore waters. So they're not required. I mean, they're required by law to do it, but the MMS said, well, sorry, you guys, we're just going to let you do it without an EIS, you know, just because we love you. In addition,
that kind of man love is never pretty.
Yeah. And this comes on top of an internal 2008 investigation done by the Minerals Management Service, an internal audit of their own performance that found, quote, a culture of substance abuse and promiscuity, end quote, at the Minerals Management Service, wherein they found that employees like to party with, sleep with, and do drugs with energy company representatives, and that a number of employees also took bribes from energy company representatives and also went with them on ski trips and golf outings. So
we say they were in bed with the industry, we're not just speaking allegorically.
They were not only in bed with them, they were high with them as well. And also, you know, and this has been continuing. It's not just a function of the Bush era. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, right after the explosion and the oil spill in the Gulf, he said, "I'm putting a freeze on drilling permits. You know, no more drilling permits until this is all sorted out." Well, sorry, the Mineral Management Service just does what they want. They went ahead and just granted 5 final approvals on drilling permits in the Gulf just last week. You know, they're continuing to go ahead and write a blank check for the industry. So of course that led this week to the Obama administration saying, well, we're going to split the Mineral Management Service in two. We're going to put the half that issues permits and leases to oil companies into one body, and then we're going to make the second agency do oversight and safety. Well, that I don't think that's going to help much.
Well, except that there's a rather compelling reason, actually, at least from a PR standpoint, in splitting it in two, which is that the MMS also gets royalties from the offshore drilling, so there's a financial incentive for them to be cozy with the industry. And what splitting it in two would be to remove at least the obvious appearance of financial impropriety.
Yeah, but I don't think that's really going to cure the whole problem
there. No, I don't think so either.
And also other news on the oil spill too. There's been some controversy about the actual size of the spill. BP said, "Well, the leak is putting about 1,000 barrels a day into the Gulf." And then after a private group of scientists said, "Well, no, we estimate it to be by the size of the spill on the water, we estimate it to be at least 5,000 barrels a day." Then the government and BP had to sort of admit, "Yeah, okay, I guess 5,000 barrels a day is closer to what the actual leak is." And now some more scientists are coming forward, guys who usually measure these kinds of things, and they say, well, we think it could be a lot bigger than that based on some video of the leak itself. Looks to us like it could be anywhere from 4 times bigger than the accepted 5,000 barrels a day to up to 14 times bigger. Well, there are problems with this too. The scientists who are experienced at measuring these kinds of things have offered multiple times to BP and the government to come and actually measure the spill because they believe that neither the company nor the Coast Guard or NOAA has the equipment and the expertise to do this. But both BP and the government have turned them down multiple times. What it seems to be is that the government is not really interested in the leak itself. They're more interested in containing the spill, whereas they view the leak BP's responsibility. And, of course, BP's incentive is to minimize the appearance of the leak no matter what.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in additional Oil Patch news here on Oil Patch 24/7, you may be wondering what Congress is doing in response to this crisis. Well, they were considering a bill, at least in the Senate, that would have increased the liability cap for oil spills from $75 million to $10 billion, that meaning that companies like BP would have to pay that much more and be liable for that much more in terms of cleanup costs.
They would no longer be limited to just the $75 million, and then
That's right.
Anything above that, the government would have to cover.
But then Senator Lisa Murkowski, who is one of Alaska, who's one of the leading recipients of oil company campaign contributions, managed to single-handedly spike this bill thanks to the arcane and totally counterproductive rules of the Senate. It's not particularly surprising that she would do so, given that she's in the pocket of the industry. But her rationale was particularly amusing. Her concern was that the $10 billion figure was too high because it would prevent all but the biggest oil companies from offshore drilling.
Good idea.
Her concern for the little guy is really touching. But there's an obvious fix for that. Make it $20 billion.
Yes. Or 200.
Or exactly. Yeah. Why limit it to all but the biggest guys? Meanwhile, so far the BP cleanup has cost about $450 million, which sounds like a lot of money until you realize that for the first quarter of 2010, BP reported $5.85 billion in profits. So far the oil spill has cost BP about 7 days worth of profits.
Moving on, the EPA coming out with some new rules this week.
Yeah, this week the EPA announced their new rule on greenhouse gas emissions. Initially, Obama directed the EPA to rule on greenhouse gas emissions to try to force Congress's hand so that they would pass an energy bill. Of course, that hasn't worked. So the EPA came out and said that starting July 2011, new plants and companies that emit more than 100,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions and existing plants that emit more than 75,000 tons will have to apply for permits in order to do that. That will include coal-fired powered plants, oil and gas refineries, cement makers, garbage dumps, and other companies that emit lots and lots and lots of methane, carbon dioxide, et cetera.
All right. And the governor of Arizona signing a progressive bill.
Oh, yeah. This week, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer signed a bill that would penalize Arizona public schools and public school districts for offering ethnic studies classes. This bill comes on the heels of the bill that the governor signed that would require police departments to do checks of people's immigration papers. This bill was heavily sought by Tom Horan, the superintendent of public instruction, who obviously equates...
Wait. Let me guess. He's white.
Oh, yeah. He obviously equates ethnic studies with bigotry, even though he admits that he has no clue. He is completely ignorant about what goes on in ethnic studies classes. He has been invited multiple times by instructors of ethnic studies classes to sit in on their classes and see what is actually taught, and he has always refused to do so. And I find this, I think this is malfeasance myself on the part of both the governor and the superintendent of public instruction.
Yeah, it's always interesting when politicians are averse to the idea of actual learning.
Learning. You know, and this is the guy who heads the school district, for crying out loud.
Yeah. You do wonder, since most civics classes are basically white ethnic studies, whether he understands that or not. This is reminiscent of Arizona, of course, being in the forefront of the whole English only movement. It's a very similar kind of impulse. This was a number of years ago, back when that type of legislation was all the rage among conservatives. As you mentioned earlier, I was down in Arizona over this past week. That's where I was during the show last week. And I was in Tucson and was down by the border and had a chance to see the fence, and also at the conference I was at, hear a number of speakers on the immigration issue and Border Patrol policies and whatnot. And it's a really alarming situation down there. The desert is absolutely crawling with Border Patrol officers, which is obviously not working. It's not actually stopping anything, because it does nothing to stop the actual demand for people trying to flee the violence of the drug war and an economy that's been decimated by American trade policies. And as long as those people are still desperate, they're still going to try and come across the border. There's been a very intentional strategy by the Border Patrol to push people out into the Sonoran Desert, where they know they will die due to the heat and the lack of water. And the idea is, well, if enough people die, then that'll be a disincentive for other people to come across the border. It hasn't worked that way. It just means that a lot of brown people have died. And having that as intentional Border Patrol strategy, and one that is very popular with the white citizens of Arizona, is really, really disturbing, because it's not just racist, it's also mass murder.
Yeah.
And it's really an ugly, ugly situation down there. And, the whole emerging boycott movement around SB 1070, which is the immigration bill Maria was referring to, I think can't be supported enough.
Yeah, and I think the mayor of Phoenix came out this week too and said that a number of companies have said they won't hold their conventions in Phoenix this year.
Yeah.
And that's going to cost the city upwards of $90 million in tourist revenue.
And the city governments of both Phoenix and Tucson have been opposed to the immigration bill and have really fought it. And that's not just because the cities tend to be more liberal than the outlying suburbs and rural areas, but it's also because those are the folks who are going to be hurt most by the convention boycotts.
Yeah.
All right. That moves us on then to briefly discussing President Obama's new pick for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, Elena Kagan, and for folks who are listening during Counterspin, Marjorie Cohen and Glenn Greenwald did a pretty good job of outlining what the many problems are with the pick of Kagan. A lot of them centering around the fact that she has very little of an actual record on a lot of these issues. She does have a record of being overweeningly ambitious and wanting this job since, basically she was in
high
preschool. I don't trust anybody who's that ambitious and that single-minded in their focus, because it means they really haven't had much variety in their life experience. That whole empathy thing that we were talking about when Sotomayor was nominated, I don't think Elena Kagan has it. And I think the odds are very good that Kagan's an excellent candidate to be one of these Supreme Court nominees who turns out to be ideologically very different from what she was expected to be going in. And given the balance of the Supreme Court right now, and the fact that she's replacing the court's most liberal justice, that cannot be a good thing.
All right. Let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the FDIC closed 4 more banks. That means a total of 72 banks have been closed so far this year. That's approximately, well, actually it's more than double last year's rate, because the total banks that were closed in all of 2009 were 140, and the FDIC has already closed more than half that number. Unfortunately, at the end of the year, when the FDIC bailout fund for banks was in the red and they were asking for more cash, the head of the FDIC said, Sheila Bair said, well, we're expecting the bank closures to be about on a par with 2009, maybe a few more. Well, it's approximately double that. So it raises the question, is there going to be enough money in the fund to cover all the bank closures going on this year? Particularly given that in the first quarter of this year, nearly one in every three banks reported a net loss. That's not good news. Also this week in the economic news, the European Union announced their $1 trillion bailout fund. The problem with this bailout fund, however, is that it's not actually cash. What it is it's a special purpose vehicle. Kind of sounds like a Hummer, doesn't it? Special purpose vehicle that would allow the European Central Bank, the European Union, to borrow more money and then turn around and lend that money to countries in the European Union that need money to cover their own debts. So in other words, it's just a way to shift the debt or hide it in sort of an off balance sheet entity.
And what isn't unsupportable debt what crippled developing economies all through the 70s and 80s
exactly.
to begin with?
Yes, exactly. And so it's not a solution. And of course, we saw that on Wall Street by the end of the week, investors were not fooled after responding happily for a couple of days and driving up stock prices. By Friday, stock prices were down again.
Yeah, and also the electorates weren't fooled. In both Germany and Britain, there were elections over the past few days in which two governments, one conservative in Germany, one left of center in Britain, were, in the case of Germany, it wasn't thrown out of power, but they lost their majority in a special provincial election or a state election. In both cases, the electorate was very angry about the federal government's role in the Greek bailout. And this is one case where the citizens of the country seem to be ahead of the politicians.
All right. That takes us on to our other international item, which is Thailand.
Yeah, the violence in Thailand. It's interesting that the media keeps saying, well, you know, first there was an agreement and then the protesters went back on it. Well, actually, the protesters had three demands, only one of which was met. One of them, the first demand was for elections. That was the only one that was met. The second was to end media censorship of the protests. Hasn't been met by the Thai government yet. And accountability for the April 10th massacre, in which soldiers fired on demonstrators with live ammunition and killed about 26 people. They wanted the folks who were responsible for that to turn themselves in to an independent police body that would then at least question them, if not try to prosecute them. That didn't happen. And so because the protesters would not go home, the Thai government has turned against them. And even as we speak, in the last 2 days and ongoing today, there has been massive violence on the part of the Thai government trying to break up the demonstrators' encampment in the center of the city of Bangkok.
Yeah, so now you have more massacres that people will have to be held accountable for.
Yeah, and it includes assassination of protest leaders as well. You know, snipers actually just shooting people in the head.
Including generals who are...
Well, yeah, a former Thai general who was a leader of the protest movement was actually giving an interview to a New York Times reporter when he was shot in the head by a sniper.
Events.
One event to be notable. Next month, the United States Social Forum will be held in Detroit, and there will be a Northwest delegation going to that in order to raise funds for the Northwest delegation to go all the way to Detroit. They'll be having a rummage sale this morning, 11 a.m. at the Community of Christ Church, 4820 Morgan Street here in Seattle. So if you can't go to Detroit for the U.S. Social Forum themselves, help send somebody else there. Check out the rummage sale this morning.
All right. Talking with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is found wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, bottom of fish tanks, whatever. And you can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. Oh, that's supposed to be bird cages, isn't it? Anyway.
I'm giggling over here.
www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, anything like that, or if you'd like to help us with our drive to find sustainers who can help keep permanently putting out the print edition, please check in with us. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.